They ain't a steroid running through this body, baby. All this body's got in it is just a little bit of whiskey, a little bit of fight, and a big heart, and an occasional night out with a lady of the evening. That's what this body's got in it.
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Everyone, and welcome to episode 145 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, I'm going to go back to 1988 for some NWA Pro from November 19th of that year. This is a continuation of my By the Pool in Florida series. I mentioned last week how I did three shows or notes for three shows while I was down there. And this is the one that I was trying to watch on the screen at the pool, and I could barely actually see my phone for a good chunk of it because of the glare against it. But that is just a typical 2019 problem. Like, I think I had said that, oh, I would like to travel back 30 years ago and be like, this is what you're going to be doing on this date 30 years from now. You're going to be trying to watch wrestling on your phone next to a pool by the beach, but you're going to be frustrated because you're not going to be able to see it all that well. But I've done shows from this time period in the NWA. This is actually right after the sale to Turner. So I did a show shortly before that, over 2 years ago now, where I was very frustrated with Dusty Rhodes' booking. And things are in a state of flux at this point. But before I get into all that, let me get in my plugs. Yeah, that's what I do at this point in the show. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com. Facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod. That is at GF Allentown Pod. Apparently, I've just passed 700 followers. I don't know what the hell that means or how many of them may or may not be bots. I tweeted out something on Sunday morning, which would be today as I tape this, on a Family Feud, which was Sid giving a pretty good answer during the face-off round. And then it not being on the board and Sid giving a very indignant look. And I had said that Sid was smartest man alive during the 1992 Royal Rumble. And I think brushing your teeth is something that you would do after eating a big meal. Didn't make a whole lot of sense to me. But yeah, people really love wrestlers on game shows, especially me, especially Family Feud. I mean, I referenced Family Feud in last week's Memphis show with the dancing family joke. So maybe I should just do something like that. I know I talked about doing an Arsenio show for so long, and then it took me forever to actually get around to it. But the wrestlers on Family Feud one, to really kind of break that down, I think that might be a lot of fun at some point in the future. Less fun, I said I'm taping this on Sunday, and we're awaiting some measure of snow up here in the New England region. I can see that it's already snowing in New York because I have the Giants and Packers game on, and Fox has decided to superimpose the yard markers over the snow, which is a pretty cool feature, although I thought I was in some sort of drug-induced hallucination, which would have been weird since I didn't take any drugs in the last, you know, however many hours, unless you count drinking a magnum of 2018 Anchor Christmas Ale. Which, by the way, is okay, because that's the kind of beer that actually ages well. Returning gracefully to my point about the snow, I've had this headache all day, and I think it's just the anticipation of knowing that they're forecasting 6 to 12 inches where I am. And that's fine. It's just that with this being the first one, the knowledge that I'm probably going to have to do this again anywhere between 8 and 16 times between now and, let's say, mid-March, And also knowing that my commute at this point, granted, I actually can work at home now, but it, you know, while I'm still learning in my job, I would rather actually go to the office. Of course, I don't know if people are actually going to show up to the office when it snows a lot. So that's something I'm just going to have to pick up on. But it's not going to have to be an all-highway commute when I do go in the snow, because I don't feel like driving on some of these back roads that I've been taking through, like, Maynard, Massachusetts. Like, they probably don't give too much of a crap about plowing out that side road that I like to take to avoid the school zones. That probably is, like, lowest priority for Maynard or Sudbury or whatever the hell town that is. So I'm just, you know, I really am not looking forward to this at all. Especially during a time where I vowed to cut back on drinking to X number of drinks a week. If it's going to snow, let's say, multiple times in a week, which is probably going to happen in January and February, it's going to be very, very difficult on me. Also difficult is, if I do take the highway when it snows, I have this, I don't want to say it's a phobia, but it is something that happened to me in 1999, where I was driving on Route 128 north of Boston, and an 18-wheeler had a giant chunk of ice come off its roof, and it hit my windshield, and I thought, whew, got a lucky break there because nothing had happened. And then a second chunk hit my windshield and went right through it. I remember the exact date. It was January 4th, 1999. And every time I see stuff fly off an 18-wheeler or any car, even if it's like the littlest crossover, if it's a freaking, you know, smart car, I don't care what it is. When I see snow coming off of it, I just become unbelievably filled with unbelievable righteous anger. Because I'm on the right side of history on this. So all I gotta say is, if you got snow or ice on top of your car, at least make a good faith effort to clean it off, you stupid motherfucker. Really glad I didn't get injured during that windshield thing. Because, like I said, January 4th, 1999, I would have missed the finger poke of doom on Nitro when I rushed home from the Boston Bruins Calgary Flames game. I didn't need to watch Raw because I was at the taping the previous week in Worcester and I already saw Foley win the world title. So I really didn't need to actually watch it. But enough about all that. Why don't I get into NWA Pro from November 19th, 1988? The sale had been completed to Turner on November 2nd, and that was the date of the taping at WTBS, where the original Midnight Express, who we're actually going to see on this show, came on the scene and attacked the Jim Cornette's Midnight Express of Stan Lane and Beautiful Bobby during a match in which Stan Lane was actually in singles competition. Bobby was outside the ring wearing the most Cosbyest of Cosby sweaters, something that would make 1991 Jake Roberts blush. You know, he thought he was the king of wrestlers wearing Cosby sweaters. But Jim Cornette blades wearing a white suit, and then he's carrying out the bloody suit on TV for weeks to come afterwards. Reason why Bobby was not part of the match is because they had lost to the Road Warriors, the tag team titles, shortly before that in New Orleans. And that match is actually on this edition of NWA Pro. It also aired on Worldwide this same weekend. So the blood on TBS was something, you know, a little bit controversial. And because it had happened on the day of the sale being completed, they kind of had to reinforce that they did not want blood on the Saturday TV on TBS. But Dusty Rhodes' booking was kind of going off the rails at this point, because behind the scenes, he had a feud going on with Ric Flair. Yes, there had been a feud dating back for much of the 1980s on screen, but this off-screen one was kind of causing havoc in the promotions. Flair did not have Arn and Tully there. That Arn and Tully are in the WWF at this point. Flair is still the champion, and Dusty is basically doing everything to try and screw Rick over. You know, the whole, let's have Rick Steiner win the title at Starrcade, which honestly might have actually been dumb enough to work because of how crazy over Rick Steiner was. We're also going to see him on this program. But yet, with all the crap going on in the NWA at this time, once you get to Starrcade, it is a miracle of a good show. And I'm not going to say everything is great, because you have, you know, Ivan Koloff and the Junkyard Dog against the Russian Assassins. That one does not come off all that great, because, although Junkyard Dog is pretty much like the third string quarterback of Ivan Koloff tag team partners at this point. It's like, well, you'd probably want Nikita there because he makes the most sense, but he disappeared from the scene actually shortly after this week. So Junkyard Dog, his phone rings sometime between late November and the Clash on December 7th. And he comes as the tag team partner. The original partner of Ivan Koloff when he was a babyface was Ricky Morton, of all people, who was available because Robert Gibson had quit and I think gone to the AWA or something, or was just sitting at home. But it's really something of a miracle that the programming becomes good for this little while. In part, maybe because Dusty Rhodes has this little slight resurgence that he certainly would have gotten if he had turned heel in the middle of 1988, but instead he stays as a babyface, and you can tell people are starting to get sick of him. Like I said when I did that September of 88 show, but here he's got a promo on this show. You heard a little bit of it at the on the intro that I played, the cold open, but oh my God, he goes some places in that promo that is rather interesting. You could say that that's off the rails as well, but it's certainly entertaining. And Jim Cornette, you know, kvetching about Paul E bringing his Midnight Express in. So you got Cornette and Paul E, which is the best manager feud of all time for my money, because they're basically the same guy fighting with each other. It's like that Spider-Man meme where they're pointing at each other. It's like Starrcade 88 is so damn fun. And I also kind of enjoy Clash of Champions 4, although I watched that over the weekend. And there were some parts of it that I just, for whatever reason, I just decided to do whatever I was doing and not pay too much attention, especially for that 17-minute Dr. Death Steve Williams versus the Italian Stallion. Like, why did it have to go so long? Like, cut like 10 minutes out of that match and then cut an additional 10 minutes out of the Eddie Gilbert, Ron Simmons versus the Fantastics, which ran 27 minutes. And you can make a case, you know, that is a pretty good match, but there's a very, very lengthy segment where Gilbert is selling the shoulder and he actually ends up losing at the end of it. So I guess it's okay from that perspective. It's just really, really long. I had said that Dusty Rhodes should have turned heel at some point in the middle of 1988, and I do believe that, but what we get in reality towards the end of the year, in the fourth quarter of the year, if you will, is the Road Warriors turning heel to something of a controversy, considering the fact that they were still very, very popular. It's just that your babyface team at this point is the Midnight Express, so I guess you're trying to balance the scales from that perspective. But it's also that eventually the Road Warriors attack Dusty Rhodes. The original turn was on Sting, and then Dusty, once again with his booking, got himself involved somehow. He is part of the six-man tag team champions with the Road Warriors. So from that perspective, it makes sense for him to be involved. But maybe having the spike taken to the eye was going a little too far. But it's also defensible because we ended up getting some great promos out of it. That has not yet happened at this point. That actually happens on what I believe was taped Thanksgiving morning at WTBS, that particular angle. The Road Warriors late 88, it's so bizarre, the track that they're on. And we're actually going to hear from them in addition to the match where they win the World Tag Team titles from the Midnight Express. And I know I've been very hard, particularly on Animal, for his promos. But to hear him as a heel, maybe I will feel differently. Who knows? And just to kind of give a perspective on where they were at, just by looking at a card from Philadelphia from the same date that this NWA Pro aired, which drew 5,000 to the Civic Center. They're not playing the Spectrum or anything like that, because that's WWF only. Stan Lane pinned the Italian Stallion. Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose defeated the Fantastics when Condrey pinned Fulton after Paul E. hit Fulton with his phone behind the referee's back as Fulton had Condrey covered. So that's kind of a typical tag team finish for this time period. Ivan Koloff pinned Russian Assassin number 2 with the Russian Sickle. After the bout, number 2 attacked Ivan until Nikita Koloff made the save. Now, Koloff doesn't quit for another 8 days after this. NWA TV champion Mike Rotunda and Dr. Death Steve Williams, who's now a member of the Varsity Club, defeated Bam Bam Bigelow and Ron Simmons at the 19-minute mark when Rotunda pinned Simmons. And U.S. champion Barry Windham defeated Rick Steiner via DQ when Windham missed a clothesline and toppled over the top rope with the referee thinking Steiner threw him. Yet another typical Dusty-style finish from this point. And finally, Lex Luger and Sting fought the NWA Tag Team Champions, the Road Warriors, to a double countout. So there's no Dusty on that show, and there's no Ric Flair. But this is not during the time period, I don't think, where the quote-unquote Dusty flu was happening. I think that's more towards Clash 4 when Dusty gets in trouble for the spike to the eye angle, and then, you know, Dusty shows up late for the match with Animal at Clash 4, which is really, really peculiar on the TV. It almost feels like they have to stall because it is a live broadcast from Chattanooga, Tennessee. So in any event, why don't we just get right down to it? NWA Pro for November 19th, 1988. I feel Welcome to the Jungle was an appropriate song to play before getting into this show for a couple of different reasons. Number one, it was in the top 40 that week in 1988. Secondly, the first match is Bam Bam Bigelow, and that was his ECW theme in 97 and 98. But also because I really need to get myself fired up again. Just to give you a peek behind the curtain in the way I put together this show, I sit down several different recording sessions during the week. And I did the intro on Sunday, which you could tell because I referenced the NFL games that were going on as I was recording. Well, now it is Tuesday, and we've had a very bad, actually, not one bad snowstorm here in the northern suburbs of Boston, but two bad snowstorms, which would be perfectly fine if it wasn't for the fact that the drive cable thingy that makes my snowblower go forward decided to break approximately 4 minutes into me going into my driveway and trying to clear it on Monday morning. So it's been some back-breaking labor, and I've just been kind of broken by the entire experience. And not in that fun Matt Hardy way, I can assure you. So there's a cold open to NWA Pro with the Midnights and the Road Warriors, and you see Jim Cornette, who is a babyface at this point, being attacked by Paul Ellering, the heel manager of the Road Warriors, and that was taped on October 29th in New Orleans, so that footage is about 3 weeks old, but it hadn't aired on all the shows at this point. So our hosts for NWA Pro are Bob Caudle and Jim Ross. And they intro the show from Savannah, Georgia, to which I write, well, maybe it's from Savannah, Georgia. When you cross-reference it with the results, I mean, NWA Pro, it's not like it's exact the way the Saturday Night Show is, but it is what it is. So we go right in. Bam Bam Bigelow, as I said in our opening contest, against Agent Steel, which kind of a big shot name for a job guy, but Bigelow is with Oliver Humperdinck, so I am immediately rolling my eye. I've already said enough about Humperdinck. I mean, I don't understand his purpose. Maybe I just need to do a Florida show, and maybe he'll actually be good there. I don't know. The one thing about Bigelow, as he's coming to the ring here, I talked about the jazz music that for the WWF for his run in 87 and 88 and how it became the primetime theme. I'm like, how does that make any sense? And I said, well, you know, he's from Asbury Park and there are jazz clubs, I guess, on the beach. And maybe from that perspective, or maybe he just likes the music. Well, this theme that he's got in the NWA, I think it kind of makes sense for Asbury Park as well, because it sounds like a roadhousey kind of theme. And I don't mean the movie with Patrick Swayze and Terry Funk. I'm talking like, you know, the actual bar. Like something you hear in a bar in Asbury Park is what I'm thinking that it sounds like. Something about that song that seems really familiar, but I can't quite put my finger on it. So anyway, Bam Bam Bigelow. I mean, I talk about his music so damn much and how it's maybe not the most traditional thing, but there's nothing traditional about him. Just go back to his run in the WWF and how he completely skipped the path to becoming a babyface that somebody who looks like him would ordinarily go through, where he comes in as a heel and then eventually he becomes the cool heel because people react to his moveset and the flames and the tattoo on his head, and then he becomes the babyface after that. So they just kind of threw him out in the final position without going through that process. And I think part of it is the moveset, as I alluded to. Like I said, there's nothing traditional about him, so I guess if you're going to break a mold, it might as well be with this guy. He's on the U.S. title track, gonna face Barry Windham at Starrcade 88, a match that I wasn't too crazy about for whatever reason, other than Windham's performance bumping around, but we're gonna see Barry a little bit later, so I'll save my thoughts on him. It was, I guess, a pretty good match, but it comes after the Rick Steiner versus Mike Rotundo finish, and I'm sorry, it just kind of pales in comparison to that. Clothesline, headbutt, and then a headbutt to the balls where he's just kind of falling into it, and he starts working the leg, and I wonder, now, would it have been better if Bam Bam Bigelow was doing Goldberg-style squashes where he's beating guys in a minute? I mean, this is the NWA in 1988. It kind of is the style. But instead, he throws a drop kick. So, you know, he seems to be a guy who wants to be able to use the entire toolbox rather than getting himself over as a killer. But Jim Ross, he kind of talks about the concept and Bigelow being able to show all the things that he can do.
When athletes are preparing game plans, you can count on some things that a man Bigelow's size can do and some things they cannot do. But when you evaluate and scout a man like Bam Bam Bigelow, you can't eliminate any weapon from the arsenal of Bigelow. He can drop kick you. He can drop kick you from a standing position. He can fly through the air like a giant bird, no doubt. But he's so big and powerful. But his tenacity and his attitude in general is what's going to be the greatest test for Barry Windham in coming weeks.
And on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, here's this huge guy. He should just be a monster and a killer and beat guys in 40 seconds. But then this is also the entertainment business, and he can do all these things. So I don't know. Maybe Bam Bam Bigelow is just a walking contradiction, I guess. Bob Caudle remarks that he can dunk a basketball, which I kind of find a little bit hard to believe. I mean, Bigelow's a pretty agile guy, but his cartwheels are kind of shitty. I really feel the need to point that out. Now, I don't know if that's because he hurt his knee earlier in the year, which I'm very fond of pointing that out. Like, oh, he got hurt against Dino Bravo 12 days before WrestleMania, and that's why he was all screwed up. He hits an enziguri and then a front suplex, the former finishing move of his nemesis in the WWF one-man gang. And that is how he picks up the three counts. Like, all right, dude, you don't have to go through every single move in your arsenal when you're facing Agent Steel on the Saturday morning television. Like, just pick out two or three of those things and, you know, execute them well and then just be on your way. But, hey, you know what? It's kind of like he's on the first date, I think.
Well, as Jim and Bob told you at the top of the program, new World Tag Team Champions, the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors. Right now, we take you to a moment in NWA history. Jim Ross at ringside calling the play-by-play as the Road Warriors win the World Tag Team title. Let's take a look at how it happened.
I'm sure that this probably came up on a Q&A on Shivani's podcast at some point, but he goes to WWF a couple of months after this, and he has to shave the mustache because apparently only Mean Gene Okerlund could have a mustache over there. But when he leaves there after a year, he never grows back the mustache that he's sporting here. And I wonder why that is. Is it because his wife didn't like it? Or what was the deal with that? Of course, he might have grown it like at some point between the years, I don't know, 2001 and 2014, when he was completely out of view, at least from a wrestling perspective. So anyway, we get our Midnight Express versus the Road Warriors match, and this is only shot with a ringside camera, which I have to say is a little bit distracting. Yeah, it does give it like it's shot like a house show sort of feel, but it could have maybe put a camera somewhere up in the stands there. On the flip side, though, I often like these hidden gems that they show where there's no commentary and you only get one camera, but it tends to be from a hard camera position. By the way, the fact that they're phasing out hidden gems is just completely ridiculous. I mean, I don't know what exactly they're going to substitute it with, but what are you going to put on the network as kind of a regular thing when you have this giant vault, most of which they don't even freaking use? Anyway, end rant on that. It's just that the ringside camera, it's moving around a whole lot, and it does get a little bit distracting. However, as we saw in the cold open, Ellering attacks Jim Cornette, but the Road Warriors coming to the ring, and I've had criticism for them. Their WWF run was rather underwhelming. I mean, that's them entering my universe because I didn't see them so much in the NWA because I really didn't start watching it until after they were gone. The black shoulder pads, they look really badass, which goes into why did they have to wear red when they came to WWF? The answer, I don't know. Maybe red was something for merchandise purposes. I don't know. But this match is fresh because even though they had done this with the Skywalkers years before this, the Midnights were heels then and the Road Warriors were babyfaces, and now they've switched. So it's an easy way of getting a new, fresh matchup, even using the same two guys. Of course, the one that was on the table was a heel Dusty versus a babyface Ric Flair, but, well, that's a discussion again for another time. It's rather dark in the arena. I don't know if they changed the lighting at all because they were filming this match knowing that there was going to be a title change. Of course, that could give away some results, like when Flair beat Dusty for the NWA title in the summer of 86. The cameras came down and shot the last 5 minutes of the match, and they adjusted the lighting, and it kind of was a giveaway. Here, I don't know if they changed it beforehand or afterwards, as Bobby Eaton is sent into the post on the outside, like, right away. It's shades of the British Bulldogs in their match at the Hart Foundation from February of 87, where Dynamite was taken out with the megaphone of Jimmy Hart, because Eaton is going to be out of commission for a bit, so Sweet Stan and his educated feet are going to have to go it alone, and he uses those scholarly feet on Animal inside the ring. But Hawk is just beating on Eaton on the outside, which I guess just to ensure that he can never make it out, make it into the match. Lane actually goes outside and does make the save, at which point I start to think, why don't the Midnights, they have Jim Cornette there, and I have the kayfabe hat on, just take the damn count out and keep your title. Because you say, oh, it's chicken shit way to keep your title. It's like, yeah, well, it's also chicken shit for you to attack Bobby Eaton out on the floor before the match happens and you run him into the ring post. I know, you know, they're baby faces. They're going to fight back and fight honest. Like, yeah, but let's also not act like complete idiots, too. Let's use the rules to your advantage, especially when you have Cornette, who's that basically fits in with what his character always was. Cornette actually hits Animal with the tennis racket when he runs the ropes. The Hawk comes in from behind because apparently, even though this is a tag team match and it's de facto 2-on-1 with Eaton on the outside laid out, this is apparently under some sort of weird AEW time traveler rules where there are no rules for this tag match. The Road Warriors, they whip Lane into the ropes. He's grabbed up into the heart attack position. They hit the big clothesline like, wow. Stealing the Hart Foundation moves. It was pretty cool to see another tag team actually doing that. Lane is power slammed by Hawk, and they hit double elbows on him. And Eaton, he's had enough of this. I mean, he gets to his feet, and he fights his way to the apron, which is the interesting part of him walking around is that he shoves Cornette because Cornette's trying to, like, stop him from getting involved because he's too hurt. But he wants to, you know, help out his partner, Sweet Stan. But the ring is just completely cut off. And Eaton does get that tag to come into the ring, and he fights things off for a little while. But a clothesline, and he's done, like he's preparing to do a Survivor Series match at some point. By the way, Midnight Express were rumored to be WWF bound at some point in 1988. It's hard to believe that that was ever close, because I just can't picture Vince McMahon getting that excited about Bobby Eaton. And I think you know the reasons why. I mean, there's an inherent bias towards guys, you know, from Alabama. I at least that's what I think. But imagine the Midnight Express in that 10-team tag at Survivor Series 88 instead of the Bolsheviks or the Young Stallions. It's like the only way you could have made that match a little bit better. Common thing said about this Road Warrior run is, well, why did you turn them heel when they were so popular anyway and they got cheered as heels for almost the entire run? My retort to that would be, I think this run actually reminded people of why they loved the Road Warriors, and that the little tweak and turning them back heel, even for a little while, freshened up the act and reminded the public, like, oh yeah, this is why we love these guys in the first place. This is why the term Road Warrior Pop exists. So it kind of, I think it freshened them up for the long run. Because, I mean, think a couple years later, you know, they really run out of steam fast. I'm not saying it was, you know, something that they definitely had to do, but I don't think, I do think that it did freshen them up a little bit in the short term, and at least from one perspective, as we get a promo from one half of the Road Warriors, and when I see that it's Animal, I'm like, oh crap, what's going to happen here? It's Animal by himself, here goes nothing, but did this heel turn change something about him, maybe, in the way that he talks?
First turn of your body, my partners aren't here right now because of the usual airline and traffic delays. But I don't want to get into that right now. I got more important things to say. We said we are tired of carrying you, Dusty Rhodes, carrying Sting, carrying Luger, carrying Stoloff, and we set our mind on these world belts. And we got them. It don't matter how we did them. We said we were going to do it, and we did it. So we're not going to come out here and be closet champions. Because we like beating people up. Rose, Murdoch, come on. Russian Assassins, come on. Koloff, come on. Wyndham, Flair, come on. But I guess first on our list, and the guys against Tony Schiavone may want a shot at us first, are Luger and Sting. Luger and Sting, you come out here and you pose. Come out here and start flexing everything else with those pretty muscles. What you got is pretty muscles. What we got are fighting muscles. We know what to do with our muscles, and we know how strong they are, and we know how to hurt people. So you better come out here, and you are scared, and you better be scared, and you better bottle up that energy, because that may be all you have that'll save your life after you wrestle us.
Feel my dick. I am rock hard for you right now, mister. You think I'm kidding? Feel it.
Wow, that was the Animal promo that I didn't know that I needed. I've been ripping him and his promo style for months, even years at this point, because it sounds like something a second grader is saying in a book report. And here, he's just kind of off the cuff, just ripping everybody as a heel. Maybe that's what he needed. Who knows, really? That'll be my new thing. I'm going to be only doing shows with, like, cool Animal promos. Then again, I think those might be a little bit hard to find. But why couldn't he always be like this? Like, why could he be like that in the WWF? Oh, it's maybe a little too rough around the edges. So I'm going to just go right into the next match, which is Barry Windham, the United States champion, taking on Trent Knight. Windham, consensus best in the world for the year 1988 as a professional wrestler. Kind of like how El Dandy is the consensus best worker in the world for the year 1990. I give that title to Windham for 1988. He's a 6'6 athlete with long blonde hair. I mean, does anything say pro wrestler more than that? As I'm looking at my notes on the next line, I cannot decipher what the hell I wrote here. It looks like I may have written sale. BBB matches? Nope, not by height. I don't know what the hell I was trying to say there. And see, this is the problem when I take notes well in advance, although I did watch this show again just the other day to remind myself of things. But anyway, I'm going to get a Bam Bam Bigelow promo. as an inset here. I don't know why Wyndham didn't get the inset promo while Bam Bam was out there, but he does, him and Humperdinck, follow the traditional 1988 NWA rule of promos. And I think you know what that is.
You don't look at Barry Wyndham, you think he's got everything going his way. But Wyndham, you're a troubled man because you've got two, that's right, two individuals after you now. Number one, Dusty Rhodes, coming for that U.S. heavyweight title. And brother man, this man right here, Bam Bam Bigelow on your trail too. And Ric Flair, you've got to be number one on our hit list. We're going to get you both, and it's just a matter of time.
Yes, you have to mention Dusty Rhodes, no matter how awkward it is, although it's a little bit more natural since Dusty was the former U.S. champion before Wyndham, and he got stripped of the title because of the whole beating Tully Blanchard with a bat earlier in the year. But why do you care, Humperdinck? Oh, yeah, that's right. Humperdinck is in the NWA because he's a pal of Dusty. They mentioned Ric Flair, but the Nature Boy in his promos towards Bigelow during the fall of 88 kept calling him a fatty, fatty, bobatty, banana fana, fo fatty, 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 fa fatty. He basically called him fat like numerous times, which was very out of character for Flair. Now, he didn't exactly do that a lot. A dropkick, vertical suplex by Wyndham. He just shrugs off the token offense from Trent Knight and hits the lariat and gets the three count because he's from Texas. And that's why he's allowed to call it a lariat. He had a mysterious departure, kind of like Bigelow's mysterious departures over the years. Wyndham in February of 89 after Chi-Town Rumble. Something to do with him trying to get on the booking committee and failing. I never quite understood that story when I've heard it talked about on other podcasts. But hey, it doesn't take away from the fact that he was pretty damn great for the year 1988.
And fans, Tony Schiavone, I've been with every Starrcade since 1983 and very proud to have this man with me, Magnum T.A., who's our special guest host on each and every of the Starrcade updates this coming season. Fans, a big announcement. I know you're very excited about it, Magnum, that this year, Starrcade 88, True Grit, will be held on December 26th in your hometown, Norfolk, Virginia, at the Scope Coliseum. What a great announcement, and I know you're very excited about that.
I couldn't be any more excited because, you know, this is the granddaddy of them all, and I have some great wrestling memories from Norfolk. I had some of the most classic battles of my career right there in the Norfolk Scope, and December the 26th is going to be a lot of classic battles going on because we all know it all comes together at Starrcade, and I can't wait to be there and be a part of it this year.
Never actually been to Norfolk, Virginia. I was supposed to go there once, but that fell through and I ended up going to Houston, Texas for a work thing a couple months later instead. I do like the Norfolk Scope for whatever reason. I think it might be just kind of the dome structure of it, where it comes off a little bit different than some of the other buildings that the NWA was running that you'd see on TV. That's my critique of TV now, especially for WWE, where every single arena looks the same. Now, part of that is because all arenas are designed the same, but even Madison Square Garden now looks just like anywhere else because you don't have that entrance from the side the way they did at WrestleMania 10 and at WrestleMania 1 and that they basically had for most of the shows that they ran there. I like the Scope because it looked different from other buildings. And they had Starrcade 88 there. That's a good show. Starrcade 91, which I was talking to somebody about that recently. And they said that it was an underrated show and that I should revisit that. Maybe I should, but it's just the Battle Bowl thing always kind of throws me. And then you got Clash in 23 in June of 1993, which has the Hollywood Blondes against Flair and Arn, which is a match that I like, even if the booking I found a bit questionable. And Hollywood Blondes get blamed for a bad TV rating. But the thing that I remember about Clash 23 at the Scope was how very well lit it was. It struck me as like the best lit building in WCW at that time. And maybe I was just imagining things. I don't know. So Magnum TA is going to be there at Starrcade, but the only thing I remember from him, he was kind of the guest host because Ross and Cottle were doing the play-by-play. Tony Schiavone and Magnum were up in some booth somewhere, just kind of doing the stuff between matches. And what I remember Magnum is when Rick Steiner did win the TV title, he had like this incredible like half smirk, half smile as he like turned his head back to the camera as they were introing that segment. They said that there was going to be a Straight Talk with the Boss, which is the Magnum TA talk segment at Starrcade with somebody. I don't know who that would have been. My best guess is Ricky Steamboat, because it would look like they were going to be bringing him in, and they did, you know, about a month later anyway. Rumor was that they wanted to bring him in as Flair's Starrcade opponent, and it just got pushed back.
It's going to be live, and I'm in negotiations right now trying to sign up the top talent, because there's some big questions out there. The wrestling world wants to know about it, and I'm going to get right to the bottom of it live at Starrcade this year, December 26th. We're going to have some real serious Straight Talk with the Boss.
All right, it's all at the Norfolk Scope, Starrcade 88, True Grit, coming your way on December 26th. And I think fans all across the country will agree with me on one thing. This man, what do you think of? I still think of him as the U.S. Heavyweight Champion, Magnum T.A. Let's go back in time and take a look at Norfolk's own Magnum T.A.
These days, I usually don't seek out the wrestling observers from the time I'm doing a show. Maybe on occasion. I know on some of the older shows, I used to do that. Same for The Torch or any of the other ones. I do happen to listen to the podcast Between the Sheets, and they did cover this week in 1988, just a few short weeks ago, since they coincide with the calendar, the week that they're covering. That's how they do things. And they did cover 1988. And I thought it was interesting that Dave Meltzer's opinion on what comes next here, which is a 4-minute long video package / music video devoted to Magnum TA, who is not been an active competitor for over 2 years. And you think, okay, well, you know, shouldn't you be, you know, nice? I mean, they lost him in that car accident. He might have become NWA world champion someday. Yeah, I know, and everybody feels terrible about it, and rightfully so, but is this really how you want to spend 4 minutes of your programming leading up to what is your biggest show of the year at this point? I know at a certain point Super Brawl became the biggest show, but Starrcade was their biggest show in 1988, and they got 4 minutes of a guy who is basically just an interviewer. I mean, it'd be like if the WWF was running a 4-minute package for Sean Mooney or Craig DeGeorge. Now, that would be freaking hilarious, but it would kind of be a pointless 4 minutes of television. I'm trying to be delicate about this because, like I said, I feel bad about Magnum's accident. Meltzer made the same point in the Observer that I'm making here, but I'm just trying to think, like, did you ever know that you're my hero? You get the music video playing. I'm going to play some of the music underneath me talking right now, but I'm watching it, and I'm sitting in that pool chair trying not to get sunburned, but also at the same time I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? I mean, how long is this going to go on? When it reached the second minute, I was like, okay, well, this is running a little long. And then when it reached 3 minutes, I was like, is Magnum, like, was there some sort of planned return to the ring? No. He was just physically unable to do it. They show an eagle. It started out with him running through the clouds. Not entirely sure what that's about. It was so incredibly bizarre. And all it struck me as is, they never got over the fact that they lost him so suddenly. They could never get past that point. As Jim Crockett Promotions, once it becomes WCW, it kind of, I don't want to say that they forgot about him because he was still part of the picture, but it's just really, really strange. It was like, I don't want to say he was like an ex-girlfriend or whatever, but it's the question of what could have been. And once again, because, you know, I am who I am, my mind immediately went to hockey to kind of draw a parallel to this. And it's different. The example that I'm going to use is the Philadelphia Flyers. And I'm not saying that to pander to my larger-than-expected Philadelphia-based audience for this podcast. It's an example from the same time period, because in November of 1985, Pelle Lindbergh, the Vezina Trophy-winning goaltender, best goalie in the NHL in 85, dies in a car accident. Now, he dies and Magnum lives, so there's an obvious difference. I'm obviously glad Magnum survived the wreck, but it would be like if the Philadelphia Flyers could just never get past losing Pelle Lindbergh. Like, well, we can't sign, you know, a goalie, you know, of his stature. course, somebody's probably shouting into their podcatcher or whatever, like, yeah, Winston, they've had a goaltending curse for the last 30-plus years. Like, well, actually, Bob Froese stepped in that year and was a pretty damn good goalie for them for that season. And then Ron Hextall came along the next year, and he was the last great Flyers goaltender. Point is, you know, they named an award for most improved player after Pelle Lindbergh, and eventually, you know, you have to move on and honor the memory. Luckily, Magnum's still alive, but this just shows that they have some sort of mental block where, or did they just not have anything else on this program? Rerunning a music video that they played 4 years ago? If I sound like I'm not making sense here, I think the reason is because this was a four-minute segment that is almost impossible to make any sense of. I miss, you know, okay, we all miss Magnum TA. That's great. But you could have done something to enhance the promotion. Now, especially since they said there's going to be a straight talk with the boss at Starcade, and then it didn't even end up happening. But, you know, that's late 1988 Jim Crockett Promotions, or NWA in this case, for you. Mentioned before that when I was a kid, I was a fan of Michigan basketball, Michigan football, what have you, but that predated me even seeing Rick Steiner as a professional wrestler, and he is up next. By the way, I actually am old enough to remember the last time that Michigan beat Ohio State in football. In fact, I remember in the 90s, it was completely reversed, where Lloyd Carr just owned whoever the Ohio State coach was at that time. I want to say, no, it wasn't Jim Tressel. Why am I bothering myself with figuring out who the Ohio State coach was in the 90s? But anyway, just like Jim Harbaugh couldn't beat Ohio State back in those days, Ohio State couldn't beat Michigan. And that brings us to Rick Steiner, who's wearing the singlet that says Michigan on the front because he's a member of the varsity club, but he's still very much bullied by Kevin Sullivan, who represents the NCAA in all of this, which is kind of funny because around this time he's bringing in Dr. Death Steve Williams at a point where the NCAA is just laying the hammer down on Oklahoma football. That's the reason why Jim Ross has these derogatory comments towards the NCAA. It's just all sour grapes because of Oklahoma committing like numerous violations under Barry Switzer, which ended up getting him fired. Steiner is actually taking on Curtis Thompson, who is billed from Charlotte, North Carolina, but they should have said soon to relocate to the WCW Special Forces. And looking up, Curtis Thompson says he now works for JetBlue. Which, that'd be great if, like, he was, like, a flight attendant and he's working my flight. Like, I would do nothing but order drinks and ask him, like, so what was it like teaming with Todd Champion? Like, do you get these kind of questions a lot? I would kind of be like Keithy at that wrestling show 6 weeks ago, whenever it was, where he wanted to ask all sorts of weird questions. Like, yes, I want Curtis Thompson on my flight. Now, he probably is just, like, a baggage handler or something, but I'd love to see Curtis Thompson as a flight attendant on JetBlue. That's all I'm saying. So if there are any executives out there, please make that happen. So Steiner's still getting bullied, like I said, by Kevin Sullivan, not because he's Michigan and, you know, the other guys are Syracuse or Oklahoma or whatever. It's due to his perceived dumbness. Now, he's going to roll out that imaginary friend Alex around this point because he's off on his own. And I guess they felt like he needed a little bit of something. Honestly, Rick Steiner, he's kind of like Rob Gronkowski, where like everybody perceives him as this idiot because he did a PSA about Tide Pods when everybody thought that he was eating Tide Pods or thought that the PSA was encouraging people to eat Tide Pods. But like Rob Gronkowski, Rick Steiner knows exactly what he's doing. He's a licensed real estate agent in the Atlanta area. I've read off some of his listings in the past, and he seems to be pretty successful at it. So Steiner, he actually gets arm dragged first thing, which upsets Kevin Sullivan, who is wearing a Michigan jacket in support of his charge, which is kind of a rare thing. But then he catches Thompson with a power slam, which I was kind of divided between 4.5 and 5 Teds, but I'll give him the 5 Teds out of 10. He kind of caught Curtis leaping in the air. It wasn't so much like he was setting him up for the power slam. It's like Thompson leapt at him, and he turned it into a power slam. So I gave it bonus points for that. So as I said, Sullivan's in the Michigan jacket, and Steiner, for whatever reason, he decides to go outside the ring, and he grabs somebody's popcorn, which was done a couple of years later by Don Mattingly of the New York Yankees, where he went over towards the first base side to go after a foul ball that went into the crowd, and he grabbed a handful of popcorn from a kid in the front row. And now he's probably going to get elected to the Hall of Fame by the Hack Veterans Committee, which, you know, apparently will just elect anybody these days. I mean, you know, if Mattingly was going to get in, he should have gotten in from the freaking voters. And by the way, Lou Whitaker first before Don Mattingly, considering that Lou Whitaker overall has better numbers in his career than Derek Jeter. But that's all for another time. Kevin Sullivan's not happy with Steiner for taking a snack break, so he yells at him a little bit. But then Rick goes right back out and grabs some nachos. And I got to say, this might be the most relatable thing that Rick Steiner ever did.
Steiner, go down and see the kids here. Well, he's going to take time out to eat a bite now. He's a lot of energy, and all that popcorn looks pretty good. Unpredictable. Probably the most unpredictable individual you'll find in the ring now, Rick Steiner. He's got an insatiable appetite. He wants another bite. They call his nachos now. You got to have seconds.
I talked recently about trying to eat smarter rather than going on a diet that has a name or, like, you know, a set list of foods to avoid or whatever. And one of the things that I've cut out in recent weeks is Santita's tortilla chips, which are like my favorite thing in the world. And the fact that I can't have it three nights a week when I'm at home, it really kind of pains me. I don't even need to eat those with salsa. Like, I will actually eat them plain. But yeah, Rick Steiner going out to steal somebody's nachos. It might be the most relatable thing that that guy ever did. Kevin Sullivan, not happy with all of it, but Rick gets right back and hits a big clothesline. I gotta say, the NWA, there's one type of angle that they particularly love, and I say this because even though it crossed when Dusty was the booker and then when you had the committee later on, they seem to do it over and over again, and just in this time period. Back in 87, you got the Mighty Wilbur, who's acting friendly towards the fans, but he's managed by Paul Jones. And then in 88, you got this with Rick Steiner and the Varsity Club. And the following year, you got Norman and Teddy Long, and kind of the same dynamic going on. It's really strange how they kept returning to the same thing. Rick hits his belly-to-belly suplex, but does not actually go for the pin. Instead, he tosses Curtis Thompson to the outside upon the instructions of Kevin Sullivan slash the NCAA proxy, who then puts the boots. And Rick goes out there and says, you know, what the hell are you doing? Why are you doing this? As Kevin Sullivan removes the jacket and stomps on it for whatever reason. So now we're kind of putting a stamp on the split here and how that is going to go down. And I have to admit that this was well done, despite the Varsity Club's total ambiguity, which if I do one thing on this podcast, I want it to be that the Varsity Club was a total allegory for the NCAA. And Rick Steiner eventually does pick up the victory in this, but I probably should mention that. I don't want you to think that Curtis Thompson went over Rick Steiner when Rick Steiner was being talked about going over Ric Flair in 5 minutes at Starrcade in one of Dusty's matter moments. But that TV title win over Rotundo, I mean, the crowd reaction to it. When I watched Starrcade the other day, I have to rewind it like 7 or 8 times just so I could listen to that crowd at the end again.
He said to start it over. Hey. Sullivan. Rip. Sullivan. Final press. And Steiner has just become the new world television champion.
I'm going to put aside the question that I have. Why was the television title defended on pay-per-view? Shouldn't it only actually be defended on television? I think that's a discussion for another time. But listen to that crowd. I mean, they totally bought in to Rick Steiner. Maybe not to the point where he should have won the world title, but TV title? Yeah, because these fans were so conditioned to expect screw jobs in the NWA in every single title match, like it was the freaking AWA, that to have him actually win after, you know, Dr. Death came down, rang the bell, you had the whole confusion, Kevin Sullivan gets out of the cage that he was in above the ring. For Rick to win the title under those circumstances was probably a surprise to everybody there, and they were so happy about it, and they were willing to express it by screaming as loud as they could. It's just a joyous moment. And up next, we have the call-offs as baby faces. This is like Everything is Backwards Day, like NWA late 88. Ivan and Nikita are reunited ever so briefly in the fall, and they are taking on two guys who were not named or anything. And this is Nikita with hair, so you know things are not going well. And like I said, he quits about a week after this. And he and Ivan, they hug it out, which I have to say I do appreciate. But let us not forget that it is Paul Jones who has the issue with Uncle Ivan dating back a couple of months. And Paul Jones at this point, I mean, people talk about, oh, the Jimmy Valiant-Paul Jones feud went on too long. Like, no, it didn't, because it kind of captured my attention for the entirety of it. It's entertaining. But Paul Jones, by late 1988, was just completely f***ed out. Like, totally. Like, the fact that they had a retirement stipulation at Starrcade, and then he still freaking won? Ugh.
You people looking at Ivan and Nikita pull off in the ring, they're a little hard-headed. So when you people see it, tell them they're on their way out. The two rockets behind me are going to destroy them. All I have to do is figure out a time, and more importantly, figure out...
I am tired of Paul Jones, but he does make a good point, as Nikita is on his way out, albeit on his own accord, and Ivan is on his way out around the time of the end of the year. He's not there very long after Starrcade. And the Russian Assassins hang around at least for a little bit. Anyway, Ivan gains control. I noticed that once he turns babyface, he works kind of the same. And I can't say that I blame him, because he's probably in his mid-40s at this point. It's like, why the hell am I going to change my working style at this point for this little babyface run that is happening because they're... The Soviets and the United States have friendly relations with each other. Let us not forget that Ivan Koloff was doing that big boss man leg drop thing with the guy prone on the ropes. Ivan was doing that before the boss man. So let's just make that point. Ivan Koloff, as I've said, the best of all the Soviet heels. Nikita gets in. He actually ends up picking up the win with the Russian sickle. See, if he's from Texas, it's a lariat. But because he's from Russia, it's a sickle. I wonder if there are any other places, locations that have their own name for a clothesline. So I guess it's kind of slipping my mind. So yeah, this run does not last long with Nikita and Ivan, but... does take you back to 1985, like you're Marty McFly in a DeLorean hitting that wire in the town center. Imagine if that didn't work, he would have just crashed into the movie theater and died. Probably a function of this being played twice on this show and then me listening to it several times to just kind of get a feel for the music, but I kind of want to make that my ringtone, except for the fact that the phone doesn't ring because people don't call each other anymore. In fact, I had to look up. I do have the WWF All-Star theme from 84 still on my phone. It's the Moody Blues and Gemini Dream is the actual basis of the song, not Modern Love by David Bowie, although that would not make for a bad ringtone either. The problem I have with the catch the pinfalls is Not the fact that there are some people in it who are leaving, because when you're a promotion in flux, it's kind of hard to put together something like that because you constantly have to edit guys out. Like, Nikita Koloff is in there, and he's gone a week from now, and he was gone earlier in the year anyway. And Nikita's hair, and I didn't talk about this. I mean, I talked about it. Oh, he has the flat top, but it's kind of like a golf course that doesn't take care of its grass well enough. Like, his hair is, like, perfectly straight on top, but it's just a little bit longer than it really needs to be. Like he kind of let the fairways start to look like the rough, is all I'm saying. But I'm particularly mad, and maybe this is the video editor in me, that hates the fact that they loop the same flair thing two times in a row, where he's in the aisle, he spins, shows Nature Boy on the back of his robe. They show the same footage twice. You're telling me that you couldn't have gotten Ric Flair doing that with two different robes or having him do two different things? It was just a very, very lazy job by them. But with that being said, I would watch an ESPN 30 for 30 on the session musicians who put together the Catch the Pinfalls music. So up next, we have the Louisville Slugger segment with Jim Cornette. And there's no guest today. It's just Jim and his Midnight Express, who have not only lost the World Tag Team titles to the Road Warriors, but these were tough times after they were riding high because they had to give up the United States Tag Team titles because they wouldn't let them have both of them at the same time. They did a few promos on TV where they're carrying both belts, which are pretty cool to see on the Saturday TVs. Those are on the award-winning WWE Network, you know, until they probably take it away from us at some point because we haven't been good enough fans or something. So there's a burden on Jim Cornette here, and it's not just him being the best babyface manager of all time. It's that, you know, if there's anything that needs to be said about him is he really has trouble overcoming his shyness. And maybe this bad loss to the Road Warriors and him getting beat down by Paul Ellering is really going to finally help James E. Cornette emerge from his shell and be able to talk about his feelings in long form.
First thing I've got to say is there ain't no guest on the Louisville Slugger tonight because there's been some pretty rotten things going on in the Midnight Express life. Now everybody's seen at the top of the program exactly what happened with the World Tag Team Championship and the Road Warriors, and everybody also knows that there's a couple of punks running around here led by a little geek called Paulie Dangerously that say that they're the Midnight Express. Well, the uppermost thing on my mind is what they did to us, but everybody, like I said, has seen the tape of the World Tag Team Championship match, the Road Warriors, the big guys who said they can beat anybody. What did they have to do when Paul Ellering pulled me off that ring apron and Sweet Stan Lane came to save my neck? Because I'll have to say it, I can't whip Paul Ellering. I can't do it. Then they both of them jumped Beautiful Bobby from behind. They run his head into the post. They busted his head wide open, made him see double, put him out on the floor. So Sweet Stan, seeing his friend was in trouble and knowing that the World Tag Team titles were on the line, he went in there and he fought both those geeks by himself because that's the kind of guy he is, with more guts in his little finger than the Road Warriors got in their whole stinking body. He defended the belts by himself, but the odds were against him. He knew that, and pretty soon they had him in bad shape, and that's when Beautiful Bobby, the kind of guy that he is, he was still seeing double, didn't know where he was. I told him to go back to the dressing room because I was worried about him. He was already hurt. But he said, Sweet Stan's in trouble, brother, and I'm going to get back up on that ring. He pushed me off. He went up, and he got on that ring, and when Stan made a tumble right in that corner, he slapped his hand, and he made that tag, and he was kicking those big freaks' butts all the way across that ring, brother. But the damage was done, and they beat Bobby Eaton, and we lost the match, and we got nobody to blame but ourselves, because Road Warriors, we trusted you just a little bit too much, just like Sting and Luger trusted you and got the shaft, just like all these wrestling fans trusted you and got the shaft. The Midnight Express put that much too much trust in the Road Warriors, and we got the shaft too. We got caught with our pants down, and we lost the World Tag Team title. Well, Road Warriors, let me tell you something. For the first time ever, I'm taking the blame. The Midnight Express got beaten. It was our fault. That's right. Because we thought you geeks. We thought you geeks were what you said you've been all these years, on the right side of things. Well, we ain't going to make that mistake again. And Road Warriors, you say you like to fight. Well, brother, I'm glad, because you got the guts to get back in the ring with the Midnight Express and put the title on the line. You're going to have the damnedest fight you ever been in. And Paulie Dangerously and the original Midnight Express.
Next week, we're going to have the tape of what you did to me and what you did to these men. But until then, I want to leave you with this. There's only one Midnight Express, and it's Jim Cornette, Bobby Eaton, and Stan Lane. Always has been and always will be. We are the Midnight Express. And Polly, I hope you look good in red. I hope it's your color, because that's what you're going to be covered in by the time we get finished with you.
It's quite a bit to unpack in that one. Maybe I should have just played that promo in lieu of doing the play-by-play, or for whatever it's worth, that I do for the Midnight Express Road Warriors match earlier on. I mean, he basically described the whole thing in much more fiery terms than I did. So, I don't know. Maybe I should just go back and dub that over what I was saying. But sometimes, you know, you listen to Jim Cornette. Yeah, he's got a lot of fire here. But I like to look at the other guys. And I'm more used to, because I watch more of the Bobby and Stan era than I do of Bobby and Dennis. For whatever reason. 86. I probably should watch more 86, because since that's all on the network as well, at least for the Saturday shows. But sometimes it's 2 hours. It's hard to get through. I know it's only an hour and 20 minutes. But I like to watch Bobby Eaton just to see what he's doing, because we know that he is secretly a comic genius from the Blue Bloods skits that he worked with Regal. I know Regal was probably the comedic worker of the group, but Eaton had to do his bit as well. So I like to look to see, you know, what he's going to stare at blankly, just kind of looking around, like, just kind of aimlessly. Nothing really going on. I mean, Stan Lane, on the other hand, he's basically, especially when he's in Techwood Studio, he's looking around, counting the number in his head, the number of women he's boned in that particular studio audience. I mean, that's just a fact of life that Stan Lane, that is what he would do. So yeah, watch Bobby Eaton when Jim Cornette talks, because the next time Cornette says something offensive, it might go over your head because you're too busy enjoying Bobby Eaton just in general. It's a shame that the Midnight Express getting attacked by the original Midnight Express will be on tap for next week's show, the November 26th. Maybe I should just cycle back when that gets posted to YouTube and do that one. They don't even wrestle here! Of course, there was a bit of, that angle was built up, I guess, in the Atlanta area with Paul E. doing some talk show with Gordon Solie, and I forget the entire deal, but that's an angle that I definitely want to cover in the future. But yeah, that is 3 minutes of promo gold from babyface manager Jim Cornette, and he didn't even have to refer to fried chicken, Ethiopians, or any of his old standards, although he might be in trouble if the word geek starts to get treated like the way Dave Meltzer considers the word mark. Mentioned before the legal requirement of babyfaces to mention Dusty Rhodes at some point in their promo in the year 1988. I mean, just watch all of the TV. It always happens, and it's just without fail. But here's Dusty wearing his best windbreaker for whatever reason. I don't know why I'm laughing at him wearing that, but it did look kind of ratty. I don't like the way I look in windbreakers sometimes. That's why I basically go from, like, just a hoodie, zip-up hoodie all the way to a winter coat. I don't stop in between for no windbreakers or anything. And Dusty, certainly in a little bit of disarray. His booking is kind of going off the rails late in the year. We're still a little bit away from the spike, but what's behind the spike to the eye angle? What set that up? Well, this is a reminder that the NWA had six-man tag titles at this point, which not something that was played up a lot, but the Road Warriors and Dusty were the champions, and the Road Warriors are now heels. Dusty's still a babyface, so how's that going to play out? You got the Flair thing going on behind the scenes. Oh, he wants a piece of the U.S. title, and Barry Windham had that earlier on mentioned. He's at war with Kevin Sullivan, Al Perez, Gary Hart. I mean, sure, who do you got? If Dusty's involved in everything, you can't get rid of him, right? So I'm going to take a guess, hypothesis, if you will, that the Road Warriors don't like to be called out publicly, and Dusty does exactly that. But he goes a little over the top and goes to some places that you don't ordinarily hear in your normal wrestling promo from the 80s.
But there's something just a little more in my crawl than Starrcade 1988, True Grit, if you will. I feel a little bit responsible for my new world's tag team champions, the Road Warriors. The bottom line is, brother, that the Stinger and Lex Luger ain't gonna let this thing pass. They ain't gonna let this thing go by. The Road Warriors got to be stopped right now. So personally, I've taken it upon myself to tell you something, animal. You're always out here when the rest of them are gone somewhere, when the planes are late or the cars are late. Animals out here talking about how bad they are, and everybody should be scared of them. Well, let me tell you something, baby. They ain't a steroid running through this body, baby. All this body's got in it is just a little bit of whiskey, a little bit of fight, and a big heart, and an occasional night out with a lady of the evening. That's what this body's got in it. So let me tell you something, big boy. The Road Warriors, Paul Ellering, my six-man tag team champions, remember that? Now then, dues got to be paid. In public, if you will. In public, if you will. So Hulk, you get yourself ready, 101. Animal, you get yourself ready, 101. Or you both come out here and jump on this man, Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. Because now is the time to tell it like it is. And Dusty Rhodes, damn sure, ain't scared of the Road Warriors. And that, my friend, is funky like a monkey.
Now, am I supposed to believe Dusty Rhodes when he says that he did not use steroids or that there was not a steroid in his body? I mean, think of Rafael Palmeiro before Congress and how emphatic he was. Why would Dusty bring it up? Nobody was talking about steroids. Were the Road Warriors using them? Yeah, almost certainly. I don't know why he felt the need to bring that up. Okay, Dusty, we believe that you're not on steroids. With that physique, but still pretty good promo, especially considering the September of 88 show. I blew up Dusty in the promo. That was the birth of the Gap Band blowing up a promo. That was Dusty Rhodes. But here, I don't know, this gives him something to do. I was talking about how it freshened up the Road Warriors a little bit. It may have freshened up Dusty a little bit as well, although maybe this, yeah, the spike thing was a little bit too far. I mean, you know, I could stand the level of blood and guts in my wrestling, but even when I see that, I'm like, all right, you rip the thing off and then to try to stab the guy's eye out. Like, the only positive with that is it led to the Dusty Rhodes promo of violence for the sake of violence.
It's violence for the sake of violence, and now I will turn it around to my violence, my lightning bolt, my fire, my thunder, an eye for an eye.
So to finalize your timeline, next week is the spike, and then the week after that is that great promo. Poor Animal, he does the promo of his life, at least from the stuff that I've watched. It's still only the third best one on this show because you got Cornette and Dusty, you know, coming in ahead of him. And we got Cornette's rival, Paulie Dangerously, in the original Midnight Express. They are taking on Gary Royal and Mike Justice. Royal Justice would be a name of, like, those guys outside Buckingham Palace. Or what do they call them? The Bobbies? They could be, like, a heel tag team, but they never talk. So you would need, like, a English manager of some kind. I for whatever reason, I can't think of a good English heel manager. Maybe Lord Al Hayes from back in the day. Who knows? But Cornette and Paulie Dangerously, this is the greatest manager feud of all time because they're such natural rivals. Paulie being from the north, Cornette being from the south, them having completely different sensibilities about wrestling, but also them being extremely passionate about it, and they just fit together like a yin-yang symbol. Maybe that's why Rob Van Dam wore it all the time. Nah, I bet it was all the weed. So the original Midnights, they jump them at TBS, as I talked about earlier. And that is how the feud gets going. They don't even wrestle here. Yeah, I've got to do that at some point. It takes a little bit for Ravishing Randy Rose to get going. I don't like the fact that he calls himself Ravishing Randy Rose because there's already Rick Rude And Randy Rose is not the most attractive guy in the world. Also, one of the worst matches in the history of Greetings from Allentown was in early, I don't know what show it was. It had to have been a WCW main event. It was Ron Simmons versus Randy Rose, and it was just terrible. It was from 1989 after Randy Rose mysteriously came back after losing the Loser Leaves Town match at Chi-Town Rumble. When he tags out to Dennis Condrey, he just doesn't waste any time and hits the skull-crushing finale, which, yes, that is what he was using. And he used it in the attack on the Midnights at Techwood Studio. A kind of a cool move when it's done by Dennis Condrey. But The Miz, who I like The Miz, I respect him and all, but I'm sorry, you're not Dennis Condrey. I'm not saying you don't have permission to do the move. In fact, my manager, the receiving manager at the PetSmart I worked at in like 1997 or whatever it was, who loved wrestling and actually ended up getting me back into it to a certain extent, he said that if he had ever become a pro wrestler, that would have been his finisher. Which, you know, I didn't know about Dennis Condrey back then because I didn't see all this footage, but it's kind of cool to go back and look at it now. So this is one of those kind of typical NWA squash matches where it's over in about 45 seconds to a minute. But what this allows us to have is, I don't know what's going on in the fall of 1988 down there, but we got, I know this is Scott Criscolo word here, a veritable cornucopia of great promos because Paulie Dangerously has seen Dusty. He's seen Jim Cornette say his piece. Obviously, they're rivals. And then Animal. Do you think Paulie Dangerously, who is new to World Championship Wrestling, the NWA, do you think he's going to allow himself to be outdone by Animal of the Road Warriors? I don't think so. But what I'm curious about is, on what basis are they the original Midnight Express? Condrey was one of them. Rose, I don't think, has the greatest case, I don't think. But, hey, let's hear it from Paulie.
Fans can pick Jim Cornette, Bobby Eaton, and Stan Lee. The fans can love their newfound heroes who stood up to the mighty Road Warriors. The fans can say, oh, they're the real Midnight Express. But you look in the history book, and you'll see that lover boy Dennis Condrey, that ravishing Randy Rose, they are the original Midnight Express. Jim Cornette, you're a stinking sequel. You're nothing but a stinking copycat. You got two losers. You got two guys that can't even defend a world tag team championship. And for stealing our name, Jim Cornette, I will be your judge. And I will be your jury. And I find you guilty. And I sentence you not only to the beating of your life, but to death. Jim Cornette, Bobby Eaton, Stan Lane, the three of you cannot hold up to the original Midnight Express. Oh, you can have the people cheer for you, and you can have fan clubs, and you can have your tennis racket, but who gave you the beating of your life? Who put you down, huh? 5 years, nobody's ever put you down, Jim Cornette, and in 30 seconds, we did it. Paulie Dangerously, Loverboy Dennis Condrey, and Ravishing Randy Rose. The NWA was the greatest organization ever in sports. And now that we're here, we're taking this place over. And there's nothing Cornette, Eden, Lane, or even you can do about it. You understand?
I'm the message.
Jim Cornette, I promise you one thing. You had a great 5 years. It's time to step aside and realize that it's our name. And we are here to claim it. You understand? You're out of wrestling.
Wow, it's like one of those ECW locker room speeches prior to the pay-per-view. I know that's immortalized in Beyond the Mat with the barely legal speech. But yes, he's going to drive Jim Cornette out of the NWA. And then finally, in the year 2019, Paul Heyman achieved his goal of driving Jim Cornette out of the NWA by raising a ruckus on social media. I'm, of course, just kidding. It's just funny to hear something like that, given the events of Cornette on the NWA Power show recently. And that's pretty much a wrap. We see that Virgil Runnels is still the executive producer of NWA Wrestling, which, I don't know, pretty good job here. Although, like I said, poor Animal does the promo of his freaking life, and he finishes fourth on this show. He doesn't even make the medal stand, but that is it for NWA Pro for November 19th, 1988. Before I do my usual podcast plugs, I will be on the Place to Be podcast this coming Monday discussing the main event from February of 1990, which features James Buster Douglas, because you always have to say James Buster Douglas's full name, because you can't just say Buster Douglas, you have to say James Buster Douglas. It's literally the number one thing that I remember from watching that show about 2 or 3 months ago, and I'm going to watch it again in taking notes for that show. Now, on the Sportscasters with my Adams Vision podcast partner, Steve Bennett, and yes, that is going to happen. We just have not put together a time for our 1994-themed ADP. He's got Jimmy Traina on his latest episode talking about why Howard Stern has not jumped the shark. Now, I'll grant you that that was obviously recorded before Hillary Rodham Clinton appeared on the Howard Stern show. I mean, talk about something that's just incredibly eye-roll inducing to anybody who has followed Howard over the years. I mean, I accidentally put it on the radio yesterday. It was on the day before the show drops, and I was like, I can't listen. I cannot listen to her voice. I didn't vote for her in 2016, and no matter what you say about Donald Trump and how whatever your feelings are for him, she lost to that guy, okay? She lost to him. And I know, oh, she got 3 million more on the popular vote. Well, yeah, I was at a baseball game once where the Orioles out-hit the Red Sox 13-7 and lost 5-0. You know what? It's not about hits. It's about runs. They knew the rules going in. Anyway, end rant on that one. My usual podcast plugs on the Our Vantage Point podcast. Back on track here. They look at, with Joe Morata and Michael Quinn, looking at NWA from January of 1986. I was just talking about that earlier. So clearly that must have been some sort of earworm to me. And I've got to start watching that a little bit more frequently. Because I always talk about carving out time to watch wrestling, and then I end up only watching this. And then last Saturday night, I watched all this extra stuff and not NWA 86. And on the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Brawler Brian Malonis and Brian Fury. It's kind of an oldie but goodie from them, from one of their old, I think it was Thursday shows that they did for BDA Radio, talking about favorite factions. And the thing to listen for in that is Crockett had to record a segment by himself, you know, to kind of intro, you know, what they did in that favorite factions thing. I love it when Crockett has to podcast by himself, because when people say to me, how do you do it by yourself? I'm like, I don't know. I just kind of go. Like, I'm a podcast consumer, so I've heard other people do it. But hearing Mike Crockett podcast by himself, I want more of that. I want a completely solo Crockett podcast where he talks for an hour and 15 minutes about the modern product and how much he enjoys it. Oh, boy. That really would be terrific, in my opinion. But I have some unfinished business to attend to here, and that's another edition of YouTube Comment Theater. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by actual users, and there's quite a few of them considering that this was only posted on November 21st, so it's only been up a few weeks, but there's some 20-something comments on there right now. So why don't we start with Jonathan Turbide. First time I see that promo by Dusty. He's calling out the Road Warriors for being on roids, admits having a drinking problem, admits hiring hookers occasionally. Gotta love it. Yeah, that is just wild. And completely the opposite of Ric Flair, who, you know, would give out his number of what Marriott he was going to be in. 619OG says, that Magnum TA segment is without a doubt the creepiest thing I've seen in about 40 years of being a wrestling fan. And yeah, it was pretty creepy because he's not an active competitor, but also the stuff that's going on screen, him running in the clouds and stuff, it didn't really make a whole lot of sense. HarleyMax01 says, I guess Stan Lane needed Steve Kern for this match. Oh, wait, it would not have mattered. The Road Warriors would have beat the hell out of him, too. Well, the Road Warriors and the Fabs had their matches, I think, at a certain point back. I think in 85 it was. Robert Lenartowitz says, I thought turning the Road Warriors heel was a great idea, one of Dusty's better ones. Tully and Arn had just left, so some fresh heels were needed. Yeah, I didn't even consider that part of it. The fact that the top heel tag team disappears at the same point. Sledgehammer says, I wonder why Hawk really wasn't there. I doubt it was due to traffic. Even his heels, the Road Warriors stayed babyface. I think they certainly turned up the aggressiveness a notch. I mean, I point to Animal's promo. He certainly, there's a little bit more fire behind it. Jack Barrett says, Bam Bam Bigelow was 27 when this was recorded. Hard to believe. And then he goes on and on. But yeah, Bam Bam Bigelow only being 27 at that point. It's just crazy. And that'll do it for YouTube comment there. I actually thought about skipping a week of Vinny Vegas Corner, but after going 3 for 3 on Thanksgiving Day, just kind of sticking to that one day and then nailing all three of the picks, although it's kind of a close call with the Saints and the Falcons. The Saints deciding not to recover any onside kicks is kind of payback for the Super Bowl 44 second half kickoff. I don't know what the hell that was all about. So 3-0 last week, and now 21-18 on the season. Let's go. I'll start in Tampa Bay, where the Buccaneers are hosting the Indianapolis Colts, who seem to be suddenly slumping now. Kind of falling on hard times, daddy. Yeah, they just got Dusty Rhodes on the mind. But Tampa Bay, I really want to point out, nobody pays any attention to them unless it's from a fantasy perspective. And Jameis Winston, yeah, he turned... did I just call him Jameis Winston? I might be the only person who actually calls him that and leaves out the T. I mean, most people would put the T in my name and not, in, you know, not take it away from Jameis. But anyway, Tampa Bay is one of a group of three teams that I particularly enjoy. They just all happen to be in the Sun Belt, where none of them are going to make the playoffs, but just on a game-to-game basis, I find them to be relatively entertaining. It's Tampa, Miami, and Arizona. Now, Tampa, they're like in the top five in the NFL in points four, which you would never guess that, just kind of thinking of them and the guys that they have. But they got a decision to make with Jameis Winston, if they're going to ride or die with him. And honestly, I think maybe they should give it one more year with him, even if you have to apply a franchise tag and roll it over, see what he can do, and maybe, you know, make him prove it a little bit. But Tampa's been playing quite well lately and scoring a lot of points and not been impressed with the Colts of late. Tampa's only giving 3, so I like them in that one. Going to go out to Arizona in a Super Bowl rematch from Super Bowl 43. As the Arizona Cardinals are hosting the Pittsburgh Steelers. While I find Arizona entertaining, they ran one of the great fake punts earlier in the year. There was like a triple reverse and all this other crap. Pittsburgh favored by 2.5 out there. The Cardinals are starting to fade. I don't have a lot of faith anymore in Kyler Murray to put up any points against this Pittsburgh defense. They're going to be playing for their playoff lives, even though it's that sixth seed in the AFC. They're probably going to go into a place like Kansas City or New England and end up losing in the wild card weekend. But I have to say, I'm impressed with the way the Steelers, and I absolutely hate that team and that entire organization, but I thought that it was ridiculous that they gave up a first-round pick when they were like 1-3 or whatever it was, and it actually turned out good for them, and they may end up making the playoffs, and they'll have that guy going forward. Micah Fitzpatrick, I think his name is. That shows you how closely I'm following the league. So Pittsburgh giving 2.5 at Arizona. And then finally, as part of my... I like picking against the teams that played the Patriots the week before. Actually, look it up. There is a correlation between teams that just played the Patriots and how well they perform the next week. The Houston Texans hosting the Denver Broncos, who are no great shakes. Houston favored by 9.5. Just feels a little too big. I know they got out to a lead against the Patriots, but look what happened at the end. Houston doesn't blow anybody out, it seems. So I'm going to take the 9.5 points and just pray that it's one of those Denver games where they get close and then they end up losing at the end. So Denver plus 9.5 at Houston, Tampa Bay minus 3 against the Colts, and Pittsburgh minus 2.5 at Arizona for Vinny Vegas Corner. Now, I had mentioned going on the Place to Be podcast to cover the main event from February of 1990, and in a kind of a fun coincidence, like, I did not do this on purpose, but next week on Greetings from Allentown, I'm going to be covering a WWF show from February of 1990. It will be February 11th, 1990's Wrestling Challenge with Tony Schiavone nearing his last days in the WWF alongside Gorilla Monsoon. And the hook in this episode is the first ever singles match on television, at least in the WWF, and I don't know where the hell else they would have had a one-on-one match, Shawn Michaels versus Bret the Hitman Hart. That should be something else. But until then, why don't you leave a five-star review for Greetings from Allentown on Apple Podcast? Because it provides what is known as social proof that you are listening to and enjoying this podcast. And I was just really distracted by the fact that I said five star. It was one of those deals where I'm looking at one of my old notebooks across the table, and I like to get the five star notebooks. And I was looking at the word five star as I was saying the word, please leave it, you know, five star review. So I'm just thrown out. Apparently, I'm just going delirious at this point. So I'm going to duck out for now and tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
I promise you one thing. You had a great 5 years. It's time to step aside and realize that it's our name. And we are here to claim it. You understand? You're out of wrestling!